Chapter 31. Submit to behold the entire collection of faces that have come to pass a January week or two at Chesney Wold, and which the fashionable intelligence, a mighty hunter before the Lord, hunts with a keen scent, from their breaking cover at the court of St. James to their being run down to death. The place in Lincolnshire is all alive. By day guns and voices are heard ringing in the woods. Horsemen and carriages enliven the park roads, servants and hangers-on pervade the village and the Dedlock Arms. Seen by night from distant openings in the trees, the row of windows in the long drawing room, where my lady's picture hangs over the great chimney piece, is like a row of jewels set in a black frame. On Sunday the chill little church is almost warmed by so much gallant company, and the general flavor of the Dedlock dust is quenched in delicate perfumes. The brilliant and distinguished circle comprehends within it no contracted amount of education, sense, courage, honor, beauty, and virtue. Yet there is something a little wrong about it in despite of its immense advantages. What can it be? Dandyism? There is no King George the Fourth now, more the pity, to set the dandy fashion. There are no clear starched jack towel neckcloths, no short-waisted coats, no false calves, no stays. There are no caricatures now of effeminate exquisites so arrayed, swooning in opera boxes with excess of delight, and being revived by other dainty creatures poking long neck scent bottles at their noses. There is no beau whom it takes four men at once to shake into his buckskins, or who goes to see all the executions, or who is troubled with the self-reproach of having once consumed a pea. But is there dandyism in the brilliant and distinguished circle notwithstanding, dandyism of a more mischievous sort, that has got below the surface, and is doing less harmless things than jack-toweling itself and stopping its own digestion, to which no rational person need particularly object? Why, yes. It cannot be disguised. There are at Chesney Wold this January week some ladies and gentlemen of the newest fashion, who have set up a dandyism in religion, for instance. Who in mere lackadaisical want of an emotion, have agreed upon a little dandy talk about the vulgar wanting faith in things in general, meaning in the things that have been tried and found wanting, as though a low fellow should unaccountably lose faith in a bad shilling after finding it out. Who would make the vulgar very picturesque and faithful by putting back the hands upon the clock of time and cancelling a few hundred years of history. There are also ladies and gentlemen of another fashion, not so new, but very elegant, who have agreed to put a smooth glaze on the world, and to keep down all its realities. For whom everything must be languid and pretty. Who have found out the perpetual stoppage. Who are to rejoice at nothing, and be sorry for nothing. Who are not to be disturbed by ideas. On whom even the fine arts, attending in powder and walking backward like the Lord Chamberlain, must array themselves in the milliner's and tailor's patterns of past generations, and be particularly careful not to be in earnest, or to receive any impress from the moving age. Then there is my Lord Bootle, of considerable reputation with his party, who has known what office is, and who tells Sir Leicester Dedlock with much gravity, after dinner, that he really does not see to what the present age is tending. A debate is not what a debate used to be, the house is not what the house used to be, even a cabinet is not what it formerly was. He perceives with astonishment that supposing the present government to be overthrown, the limited choice of the crown, in the formation of a new ministry, would lie between Lord Cootle and Sir Thomas Doodle, supposing it to be impossible for the Duke of Foodle to act with Cootle, which may be assumed to be the case in consequence of the breach arising out of that affair with Hoodle. Then, giving the Home Department and the leadership of the House of Commons to Joodle, the Exchequer to Cootle, the Colonies to Loodle, and the Foreign Office to Moodle, what are you to do with Noodle? You can't offer him the presidency of the Council, that is reserved for Poodle. You can't put him in the woods and forests, that is hardly good enough for Quoodle. What follows? that the country is shipwrecked, lost, and gone to pieces, as is made manifest to the patriotism of Sir Leicester Dedlock, because you can't provide for Noodle. On the other hand, the Right Honorable William Buffy, MP, contends across the table with someone else that the shipwreck of the country, about which there is no doubt, it is only the manner of it that is in question, is attributable to Cuffy. If you had done with Cuffy what you ought to have done when he first came into Parliament, and had prevented him from going over to Duffy, you would have got him into alliance with Fuffy. You would have had with you the weight attaching as a smart debater to Guffy. You would have brought to bear upon the elections the wealth of Huffy. You would have got in for three counties Juffy, Cuffy, and Luffy, and you would have strengthened your administration by the official knowledge and the business habits of Muffy. All this, instead of being as you now are, dependent on the mere caprice of Puffy. As to this point, and as to some minor topics, there are differences of opinion, but it is perfectly clear to the brilliant and distinguished circle all round that nobody is in question but Boodle and his retinue, and Buffy and his retinue. These are the great actors for whom the stage is reserved. A people there are, no doubt, a certain large number of supernumeraries, who are to be occasionally addressed and relied upon for shouts and choruses, as on the theatrical stage. But Boodle and Buffy, their followers and families, their heirs, executors, administrators, and assigns, are the born first actors, managers, and leaders, and no others can appear upon the scene forever and ever. In this too, there is perhaps more dandyism at Chesney Wold than the brilliant and distinguished circle will find good for itself in the long run. For it is, even with the stillest and politest circles, as with the circle the necromancer draws around him, very strange appearances may be seen in active motion outside. With this difference, that being realities and not phantoms, there is the greater danger of their breaking in. Chesney Wold is quite full anyhow, so full that a burning sense of injury arises in the breasts of ill-lodged ladies' maids, and is not to be extinguished. Only one room is empty. It is a turret chamber of the third order of merit, plainly but comfortably furnished, and having an old-fashioned business air. It is Mr. Tulkinghorn's room, and is never bestowed on anybody else, for he may come at any time. He is not come yet. It is his quiet habit to walk across the park from the village in fine weather, to drop into this room, as if he had never been out of it since he was last seen there, to request a servant to inform Sir Leicester that he is arrived in case he should be wanted, and to appear 10 minutes before dinner in the shadow of the library door. He sleeps in his turret with a complaining flagstaff over his head, and has some leads outside on which, any fine morning when he is down here, his black figure may be seen walking before breakfast like a larger species of rook. Every day before dinner, my lady looks for him in the dusk of the library, but he is not there. Every day at dinner, my lady glances down the table for the vacant place that would be waiting to receive him if he had just arrived, but there is no vacant place. Every night my lady casually asks her maid, "Is Mr. Tulkinghorn come?" Every night the answer is, "No, my lady, not yet." One night, while having her hair undressed, my lady loses herself in deep thought after this reply until she sees her own brooding face in the opposite glass, and a pair of black eyes curiously observing her. "Be so good as to attend," says my lady then, addressing the reflection of Hortense, "to your business. You can contemplate your beauty at another time." "Pardon. It was your ladyship's beauty." "That," says my lady, "you needn't contemplate at all." At length, one afternoon a little before sunset, when the bright groups of figures which have for the last hour or two enlivened the ghost's walk are all dispersed, and only Sir Leicester and my lady remain upon the terrace, Mr. Tulkinghorn appears. He comes towards them at his usual methodical pace, which is never quickened, never slackened. He wears his usual expressionless mask, if it be a mask, and carries family secrets in every limb of his body, and every crease of his dress. whether his whole soul is devoted to the great, or whether he yields them nothing beyond the services he sells, is his personal secret. He keeps it, as he keeps the secrets of his clients. He is his own client in that matter, and will never betray himself. How do you do, Mr. Tulkinghorn? Says Sir Leicester, giving him his hand. Mr. Tulkinghorn is quite well. Sir Leicester is quite well. My lady is quite well. All highly satisfactory. The lawyer, with his hands behind him, walks at Sir Leicester's side along the terrace. My lady walks upon the other side. We expected you before, says Sir Leicester. A gracious observation. As much as to say, Mr. Tulkinghorn, we remember your existence, when you are not here to remind us of it by your presence. We bestow a fragment of our minds upon you, sir, you see. Mr. Tulkinghorn, comprehending it, inclines his head, and says he is much obliged. I should have come down sooner, he explains, but that I have been much engaged with those matters in the several suits between yourself and Boythorn. A man of a very ill-regulated mind, observes Sir Leicester with severity. An extremely dangerous person in any community. A man of a very low character of mind. He is obstinate, says Mr. Tulkinghorn. It is natural to such a man to be so, says Sir Leicester, looking most profoundly obstinate himself. I am not at all surprised to hear it. The only question is, pursues the lawyer, whether you will give up anything. No, sir, replies Sir Leicester. Nothing. I give up? I don't mean anything of importance. That, of course, I know you would not abandon. I mean any minor point. Mr. Tulkinghorn, returns Sir Leicester, there can be no minor point between myself and Mr. Boythorn. If I go farther, and observe that I cannot readily conceive how any right of mine can be a minor point, I speak not so much in reference to myself as an individual as in reference to the family position I have it in charge to maintain. Mr. Tulkinghorn inclines his head again. I have now my instructions, he says. Mr. Boythorn will give us a good deal of trouble, it is the character of such a mind. Mr. Tulkinghorn, Sir Leicester interrupts him, to give trouble. An exceedingly ill-conditioned, leveling person. A person who, 50 years ago, would probably have been tried at the Old Bailey for some demagogue proceeding, and severely punished if not, adds Sir Leicester after a moment's pause, if not hanged, drawn, and quartered. Sir Leicester appears to discharge his stately breast of a burden in passing this capital sentence, as if it were the next satisfactory thing to having the sentence executed. But night is coming on, says he, and my lady will take cold. My dear, let us go in. As they turn towards the hall door, Lady Dedlock addresses Mr. Tulkinghorn for the first time. You sent me a message respecting the person whose writing I happened to inquire about. It was like you to remember the circumstance. I had quite forgotten it. Your message reminded me of it again. I can't imagine what association I had with a hand like that, but I surely had some. You had some? Mr. Tulkinghorn repeats. Oh, yes, returns my lady carelessly. I think I must have had some. And did you really take the trouble to find out the writer of that actual thing? What is it, affidavit? Yes. How very odd. They pass into a somber breakfast room on the ground floor, lighted in the day by two deep windows. It is now twilight. The fire glows brightly on the paneled wall, and palely on the window glass, where, through the cold reflection of the blaze, the colder landscape shudders in the wind, and a gray mist creeps along, the only traveler besides the waste of clouds. My lady lounges in a great chair in the chimney corner, and Sir Leicester takes another great chair opposite. The lawyer stands before the fire with his hand out at arm's length, shading his face. He looks across his arm at my lady. Yes, he says, I inquired about the man, and found him. And, what is very strange, I found him not to be any out-of-the-way person, I am afraid. Lady Dedlock languidly anticipates. I found him dead. Oh, dear me, remonstrated Sir Leicester, not so much shocked by the fact, as by the fact of the fact being mentioned. I was directed to his lodging, a miserable, poverty-stricken place, and I found him dead. You will excuse me, Mr. Tulkinghorn, observed Sir Leicester. I think the less said, pray, Sir Leicester, let me hear the story out. It is my lady speaking. It is quite a story for twilight. How very shocking. Dead? Mr. Tulkinghorn reasserts it by another inclination of his head. Whether by his own hand, upon my honor, cries Sir Leicester. Really? Do let me hear the story, says my lady. Whatever you desire, my dear. But, I must say, no, you mustn't say. Go on, Mr. Tulkinghorn. Sir Leicester's gallantry concedes the point, though he still feels that to bring this sort of squalor among the upper classes is really, really, I was about to say, resumes the lawyer with undisturbed calmness, that whether he had died by his own hand or not, it was beyond my power to tell you. I should amend that phrase, however, by saying that he had unquestionably died of his own act, though whether by his own deliberate intention, or by mischance, can never certainly be known. The coroner's jury found that he took the poison accidentally. And what kind of man, my lady asks, was this deplorable? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.